the heat is on, and pretty soon it'll all be gone. Time is short to change the score, or look in Webster's for dinosaur. 24 years, 90%, get evicted or pay the rent. There are just two words that will decide: carbon dioxide. Does anything matter?
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, your watchdog for nature on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. As humans toil their way towards a steaming hot world, we all have to do our part. The government of British Columbia doesn't want to be left out of the carbon race, and that is why, ladies and gentlemen, we propose a new green energy to power the province. It's all quite natural, coming right out of the ground. Yes, it's coal. Yep, the suits at BC Hydro, cheered on by the Liberal Party, want to build the first two coal-burning power plants in the province. So far, we've managed with those old-fashioned hydroelectric dams and a few gas-burning power plants. But this is the new age, the next carboniferous age. Why be left behind in a cloud of CO2 when we can make our own right here at home? Okay, the Grinches at Environment Canada released a report December 21st. They say Canadian coal-fired plants tossed 280 million tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere in 2005. Why should we be left behind? Let's make even more! And that's just what will happen if BC Hydro goes ahead with plans to build two new coal-fired power generation facilities. One would go up north in Tumbler Ridge, the other right at the top of the Similkameen Valley in Princeton. All the good black specks can blow into your lungs east over that ugly Okanagan Valley, where practically nobody lives and nobody cares what happens. Well, a few people care. About 100 protesters from both Princeton and the Lower Mainland did picket the Chilliwack office of BC Environment Minister Barry Penner last month. According to the Vancouver Sun, the top man speaking for the biggest electricity guzzlers don't see what all this panic is about. Dan Potts is executive director of the Joint Industry Electricity Steering Committee. He told the Sun, quote, "There seems to be almost a panic with respect to greenhouse gases. Maybe there is some justification for it. I don't know. But where that kind of attitude rules, we are very likely to make some bad fundamental policy decisions." End quote. The pine forests are dying due to global warming, allowing the new insect pests. Tofino ran out of water. Storms are smashing the province. The Arctic is melting. But hey, if there's any justification for worry, Dan Potts doesn't know about it. The Princeton coal scam is proposed by a company called Compliance Energy. In March 2005, Compliance announced 100% acquisition of the Basin coal mine near Princeton. The company also has an interest in two coal deposits on Vancouver Island. They say they will reduce their carbon footprint by burning wood along with the coal. The logic is that wood releases carbon when it decays anyway, so why not burn it? Maybe they can burn all the red dead pine trees in Manning Park and all around Princeton already killed off by climate change. The Tumbler Ridge gang is called AES Wapiti Energy Corporation. That's a joint development company formed by AES, a huge international power company with 122 power plants, and Hillsborough Resources. AES is the big money, with operations in 27 countries and headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. Almost 40% of AES energy comes from 31 coal plants. Welcome to our green little province, Mr. Global Polluter. Please make a big donation to the political party of your choice. They plan a new mine in northeastern BC, closer to the proposed power plant at Tumbler Ridge. I pity all those seniors who bought those cheap houses when the mine was supposedly closing down. Now they get to breathe all the small particles, whatever mercury that they can't scrub out, and even radioactive particles that all coal plants pump out of the stacks. The Tumbler Ridge power plant is supposed to cost $500 million, with construction due to start in November 2007, just next year, unless we stop this madness. And full polluting coal burning starts at 2010, a nice Olympic present for the world, don't you think? The company could capture that CO2 using known technology already tested here in Canada to stuff the CO2 back down into the earth, but well, they wouldn't make the big profits that way. They'll burn 600,000 tons of coal each and every year. This September, BC Hydro signed a contract to purchase 184 megawatts of coal power from the Tumbler Ridge plant. It's all green to go. Well, maybe all black to go. That's a 30-year agreement. We promise to toss up millions of tons of climate-changing gases at least until 2036. When it comes to wrecking the Earth's climate, we believe in long-term planning. There's a couple of rubber stamp approvals still required from the Utilities Commission, appointed by Campbell's government, and from the Environmental Assessment Office, also part of the Campbell regime. The company expects to start building one of BC's first climate-killing coal plants in late 2007, with a joyous opening again in 2010. Just think how that will look to the world as the cameras roll at the Olympics, as we pray for enough snow to hold the Olympics, as we try to convince the Chinese and the people of India not to build thousands of new coal power plants that will kill off life on Earth as we know it. As Brad Hope, a Princeton grandfather, told the Vancouver Sun, the Environmental Review has been set up with terms of reference that exclude any arguments about the impact of these coal plants that they'll have on the climate. Well, why even talk about that? Brad is chair of the local citizen group Save Arsimilkameen. They are raising money through bake sales to oppose the multi-million dollar slush funds and publicity funds available to big corporations. Others opposing this coal-fired madness include the BC Teachers Federation, the Union of BC Municipalities, Princeton Area Doctors, and 9 environmental groups. Oh yeah, and the mayor of Princeton, Randy McLean, is totally opposed to this new coal plant. As reported in the Toronto Globe and Mail, McLean says he's been left out of consultations about building it. I mean, why ask the local people? And the 40 promised jobs, just to power 40,000 homes, just isn't worth the damage coming to local real estate, tourism, and people's health. McLean says the coal plant is being dumped on a rural area because, quote, they feel they can get away with it here. Tom Hackney, the BC Hydro Specialist for the BC Sustainable Energy Association, says coal is absolutely not the way to go. We have plenty of options through wind and all kinds of other good energy sources here in BC. Now, these two coal plants, folks, all by themselves will double the amount of greenhouse gases British Columbia creates for power generation. Well, let's go for it. We should double all our CO2 emissions, just to see what happens. Maybe we can finally open those tropical resorts in Prince George after Richmond floods out. Then maybe we can come to our senses here in BC before it really is too late. Not sure what to do about it? Try visiting the Sierra Club website at www.sierraclub.ca/BC. You'll find a letter there you can send to Premier Gordon Campbell today. Or pick up your BC Coal Electricity Fact Sheet at www.bcsea.org. You are tuned to CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. And now, you are going to get an earful about the damage that coal-fired power plants do around the world, and why progressive places are closing them down, not building new ones. You've heard the news. 30% of Arctic ice gone. Floods, storms, fires. We're pushing the Earth over a very big climate cliff. The time for talk is over. We need to act now.
It's the tough news from Radio EcoShock.
Human-made carbon is pouring into the Earth's atmosphere. According to The Independent, global warming will speed up due to a sharp rise in greenhouse gases. During the last 50 years, carbon increased by an average of 1.3 parts per million every year. In 2002 and 2003, it was 2 parts per million more per year. Unpublished reports for 2005 make it 2.2 parts per million. It's climbing rapidly and piling up each and every year we burn fossil fuels. Coal is one of the biggest sources of carbon dioxide. It's the dirtiest fossil fuel we burn. There are plenty of cleaner alternatives. It's an emergency. We need to stop coal mining and coal burning now, today. This isn't just an environmentalist demand. A wide range of governments, scientific institutions, and planners have recognized that coal has to go. One of the leading examples for a rapid phase-out of coal is Ontario, the most industrialized province of Canada. The Ontario government has promised a complete phase-out of coal power by 2007 in Canada's largest industrial province. But Ontario's unreliable nuclear power plants, rapidly reaching their age limits, led past governments to increase coal by 120% between 1995 and 2003. Yet, with limitations on coal use, the province has not experienced brownouts or blackouts and continues to grow economically. There has been a positive response to government initiatives to produce more alternative energy. A report on the phase-out in Ontario is available from www.toronto.ca and from the Ontario Clean Air Alliance. They demand that the capital city, Toronto, phase out purchases of electricity generated from coal in order to fight off the growing problem of smog alerts. On June 16, 2005, the government of Ontario announced a delay in its deadline to shut down all its coal-fired plants. The largest coal power station will remain in service until 2009, and Ontario will try to refurbish two of its broken nuclear reactors.
Uh-oh.
The Canadian manufacturers and exporters applaud the extension of coal use, warning of blackouts and billions of dollars in damage to the economy if coal-powered plants were closed down. During the last 2 years, the Toronto area has had a record number of days where residents were advised to stay indoors due to smog. Hospitals and clinics are seeing increased breathing problems due to air pollution, and coal-burning plants top the list of suspects. This is critical. So far, the most earnest attempts to phase out coal, whether in Canada or China, arise not out of fear of a damaged climate, but from popular pressure for clean air to breathe. Even if coal pollution appears to blow away, it inexorably adds to the growing carbon content of the Earth's atmosphere. Whatever we may say, or promise for 2012 or 2050, the climate and its delicate balances of living systems are being damaged now. If we knew for certain that burning coal today will tip ocean currents, drive millions into refugee camps due to drought, and flood millions more, wouldn't we stop? We do know for certain, the facts are in. Will we act to survive? Studies by the World Watch Institute estimate that coal particulates and sulfur dioxide lead directly to 500,000 premature deaths every year. Millions of new respiratory illnesses are created by coal burning. Cities like Beijing and Delhi are close to the smog levels found in London in 1952, where 4,000 people died. Almost 2 million people a year die from coal smoke just from cooking. Asian air pollution now reaches the U.S. West Coast and coats the upper atmosphere with carbon. Governments fund these deaths and the coming climate chaos. At least $63 billion of public money goes into subsidizing the coal industry, and that doesn't really count the railways, ports, and roads and other public infrastructure built and used for the coal trade. Counting these indirect subsidies, in 1999, Germany paid out a whopping $21 billion to the coal industry. That's more than $70,000 for each and every miner. Coal is a dominant player all over the world. Coal owners have had direct access to top political leaders for decades, and they fund countless candidates. ENN, the Environmental News Network, reports that the United States and Denmark still depend on coal for 53% and 74% of electricity. South Africa and China are the most coal-reliant developing countries, with 78 and 73% shares of coal in overall energy use. For a coal phase-out to succeed, the World Watch Institute recommends a fair transition for affected workers. Coal miners number about 10 million worldwide, less than one-third of 1% of the global workforce. To minimize the dislocation of workers, the Institute recommends following the lead of governments in China and the United Kingdom, who have located solar cell manufacturing sites near abandoned coal mines. In November 2003, an independent review commissioned by the World Bank recommended the bank stop financing coal projects immediately and end investments in oil production by 2008. But a series of 19 major banks, including Citibank and Barclays, want the World Bank to keep financing new coal projects to keep on paying to wreck the climate. The World Bank caved in. Money is more important. There are environmentalists who capitulate to the need for coal power. David Hawkins, the director of the climate program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, says our political systems just cannot give up coal. It's relatively cheap and abundant. So Hawkins is supporting the proposed would-be demonstration plant for zero-emission coal burning called Future Gen. In the Future Gen model, nothing has been built or even announced, the coal would be gasified first, carbon dioxide and other pollutants would be filtered out, and the cleaner gas burned to make power. The smokestack emissions would also be captured and driven down into a repository below the earth, perhaps in an old mine or an old oil field. That's the hope to limit climate change,
Of course, it's already much too late for distant plans. Climate change is upon us and accumulating strength in the atmosphere. Meanwhile, humans cut off the tops of mountains, strip away the layers of living things to make their black gouges in the earth, to power our gaudy displays of lights and all the toys that Carbon Santa brings. There are other moves away from coal. Lester Brown tells us, the United Kingdom, which used coal to launch the Industrial Revolution more than two centuries ago, cut coal use by 40% between 1990 and 2001, mainly by substituting natural gas. Britain's coal miners have declined from more than a million workers in their glory days to less than 10,000 today. Britain's largest coal pit, the Selby operation in Yorkshire, was allowed to close in 2002. Lester Brown also says Germany, Europe's largest industrial economy, cut coal use by a comparable 41% from 1990 to 2001. Reduced subsidies, gains in energy productivity, and the massive harnessing of wind energy means the use of coal may be on its way out in Germany as well. Read Lester Brown's press briefing on December 3, 2003 at earth-policy.org. But Germany continues to subsidize coal mines and just completed Europe's largest coal plant installation. Despite legendary greens, the country remains a carbon spout into the upper atmosphere. Even the business publication The Economist ran a cover story in July 2002 with the title, quote, Coal, Environmental Enemy Number One. The magazine called for a punitive carbon tax to discourage coal burning. But the United States and Japan have increased coal use. China and India are also pumping up the coal, despite diplomatic announcements. China claims it shut down thousands of small coal operations this year due to safety concerns. Up to 5,000 Chinese coal miners die every year in widespread accidents. But China is also under pressure from city dwellers, including in the capital Beijing, due to horrible air quality. Many people moving outdoors wear breathing masks all the time. Children and old people are dying prematurely by the tens of thousands due to polluted air. The Chinese have an example of a widespread ban on environmentally damaging mining. In mid-October, China banned all gold mining in Tibet as a major source of pollution to that fragile environment. This year, the Chinese government ordered almost 2,000 unregistered coal operations closed and another 9,000 illegal coal pits shut down. At the end of August 2005, the central government ordered officials at all levels to pull out of any coal mining investments. But the country still gets most of its power and heat from coal, operated huge coal operations, and imports still more from countries like Australia and Canada. The largest single coal-polluting country, the United States, has barely whispered the idea of changing energy sources. There are movements to ban mountaintop removal mining, which chops out mountains and fills valleys with slag. Those impacted locally by coal smog have battled particular power stations. But there is no highly visible movement to save the climate by stopping coal use. The sleepers dig out dirty coal carbon while complaining about the strange weather. In Australia, the world's largest coal exporter, read Climate Profiteer, the Green Party promised to ban coal-powered electricity if elected. There have been a string of protests against coal use by Greenpeace. For example, on November 11, 2000, in the Netherlands at Rotterdam, Greenpeace activists boarded the bulk carrier La Paloma with its cargo of Australian coal. Campaigner Paul Horsman called for a phase-out of not just coal, but of fossil fuels altogether to protect the climate. 3 years ago, on June 9, 2003, Greenpeace took the opportunity of a major coal conference in Bali, Indonesia, to call for a complete global phase-out of coal. Red Constantino, climate and energy campaigner, said bluntly, "The coal industry needs to clean up its act. Because of climate change, the only way it can do this is to phase itself out, starting today, not tomorrow." The oil company BP changed its name from British Petroleum to Beyond Petroleum as a new vision for a company engaged in an unsustainable business. Likewise, the coal giants need to publish their plans to wind down their industry to preserve Earth's climates and its citizens. According to Greenpeace, coal produces over 40% of the world's annual carbon emissions. It's hardly a sundown industry. Between 1973 and 1993, global coal use rose by 36%. Coal burning exploded in Asia during those two decades, expanding 162%. Analysts predict Asia's coal appetite, mainly fed by Australia, will grow by 14% a year, even while violent storms rock the continent. All this explains why atmospheric carbon is skyrocketing. So far, the idea of ending coal use on the planet Earth is outlandish, perhaps impossible for most people to imagine. A technorati search of millions of blogs finds not one ready to end the carbon tragedy. As children of the Industrial Revolution, we are blinded by the drug that made it possible, even though we have clean, renewable technologies to replace it. Humans will spend trillions on the Iraq War and zillions on arms. They will send polluting vehicles into distant space, but they cannot see past the black haze that brought them out of the fields and into the factories. While there is an international plan to help newly industrialized countries switch away from CFCs to save the ozone layer, there is no international agreement to install clean alternative energy instead of deadly coal. Climate agreements require a whole new plan to replace coal entirely across the world as a top priority of all governments and corporations. Recent studies in Germany found that planting more trees cannot reduce greenhouse gases, cannot stop climate change. The only solution is to drastically reduce our carbon output. We are now in a crisis mode. We need to end coal mining and coal burning around the world. Try to imagine it. Talk about it. Act where you are. This report comes from Radio EcoShock, the net's only all-environment radio station. Tune in free at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. This is CFRO, Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And now for something completely different. Whether you are working for environment, social justice, or equality, you may have noticed the sad way society manages their change. A few brave people speak up and then get hung for it. Then people realize they were right and slowly make the necessary improvements. We hang our visionaries and some of our kindest people, as the story of Jesus tells so well. Today we're going to hear about the life of Wilhelm Reich. This social pioneer was out front on so many issues: sexual freedom, women's reproductive rights, freedom of speech, the rights of children, and even early environmentalism. That's why he was hounded from country to country until he died in an American jail following years of FBI harassment. Here is the story of Wilhelm Reich. There is no copyright on this work. I encourage you to record it and share it with friends. You can also download the two-part series from www.ecoshock.org. Just look for EcoShock Features in the Audio On Demand menu.
Life and Death of a Social Pioneer, Wilhelm Reich. What is life like for a person always ahead of their time, always thinking more freely, living on the edge, like Wilhelm Reich? Was he a social prophet or a con man? Why did the American authorities hound this well-known author, social investigator, and scientist? Why did he die in prison? Reich was a pioneer at almost everything. Some say he was an early environmentalist as well. Now, it is time to depart. A life is waiting to expose itself. Wilhelm Reich was born in 1897 and lived until 1957. He was born the oldest son to a wealthy, almost feudal, Jewish landholder in the last days of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Reich's relationship with his parents appear to have driven him to investigate the secrets of the mind. His mother committed suicide after the 12-year-old Reich told his patriarchal father of his mother's infidelity with the boy's tutor. His father committed a kind of suicide by disease only a few years later. These are scars that twist even a brilliant man. His next teacher was World War I. The young Austrian served on the Italian front. As Austria's 400-year empire crumbled, Reich studied medicine in Vienna. In the capital of Sigmund Freud, Reich picked up the fever for self-examination. He began to practice psychoanalysis while still a student. As the master delved into sex lives, Wilhelm Reich wrote papers on the importance of early sexuality, which were approved by Freud himself. Quick in his mind and his expression, Reich became an active leader in the psychoanalytic movement of the 1920s. After a few years, though, Reich became frustrated with the limited possibilities for social change, using the one-by-one approach of psychoanalysis. He felt he was always bandaging wounds and never stopping the war. As he enjoyed his own sex life, Reich had an enlightenment. He concluded the ability to experience a complete heterosexual orgasm was necessary to experience peace of mind. Otherwise, in a frustrated sexual state, the person built up a system of protective muscular and emotional tensions, which he dubbed body armor. 30 years ahead of his time, Wilhelm Reich championed a sexual revolution. He concluded that only a campaign of sexual liberation could fundamentally change society at all. To this end, he founded a team of physicians, social workers, and volunteers of both sexes. They traveled around Vienna in a van to pass out sexual education pamphlets, to provide or procure abortions for women who wanted them, to provide birth control, and to provide sexual counseling for teens. You might as well have lit a firecracker in the middle of old Europe. All these things were revolutionary and generally illegal in Catholic Vienna of the 1920s. Reich even advocated premarital or extramarital sex. In the late 1920s, Reich attempted to merge his commitment to social change through sexual liberation, which he called sexual politics, or sexpol for short, to the larger ideas of Marxism. In 1930, he moved from Vienna to Berlin, where there was a large Marxist movement struggling with the far right of the National Socialist Party. In the same year, Reich was expelled from the Austrian Social Democratic Party and suspended from the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society. There was a rush to kick him out, even from the most liberal institutions in Austrian society. During his period in Berlin, Reich attracted as students various Americans who later became famous psychoanalysts. By 1933, the German Communist Party, wanting not to alienate the large Catholic vote, expelled Wilhelm Reich. But the communists were already doomed. The heavily Catholic South Germany, especially Bavaria, voted by the millions for the nemesis of all communists in Germany, Adolf Hitler. Most of the party was led away to be worked to death. The expulsion and pressure may have saved Reich's life. He emigrated to spend time in Scandinavia, mainly staying in Norway. His reputation for sexual freedom, helping women, and pushing sex education followed him. In 1934, the International Psychoanalytic Association likewise expelled Wilhelm Reich. In 1939, following disputes in Norway, Reich emigrated to America, the land of the free. There he established the Orgone Institute in New England. Reich continued to research and write, not only about psychoanalysis or even psychology, but on a broad range of physical sciences, from biology to nuclear physics. In the early 1950s, he was among the few voices criticizing atomic testing in the atmosphere. Reich said there was a serious environmental risk from airborne radiation. Only a few years later, they found the strontium-90 in milk supplies and bones of children in the Northern Hemisphere. Reich believed that life itself either was energy or used a special kind of energy. Delving into the sub-microscopic world, the aging scientist Rebel claimed he had isolated a new kind of particle. This was, he said, related to the life force, which he called orgone energy. Writing in the journal Biophysical Functionalism and Mechanistic Natural Science for 1942, Reich said, "We do not intend to wait until 50 or 100 years from now the existence of the orgone may finally be conceded. It is up to us, and not to any so-called authority, to see that the existence of the biological energy is recognized." In his last years, Reich built a special kind of box which would accumulate orgone. He offered a kind of vitality treatment and sold his orgone accumulators.
EcoShock Radio, broadcast and podcast. Find us on the web at ecoshock.org.
The Strange Case of Wilhelm Reich.
Part 2. Reich, in the 1920s, focused on the orgasm as the height, as the bodily release of consciousness. His biographer, Myron Sharaf, captures this best in his 1983 book, Fury on Earth, a biography of Wilhelm Reich. Quote, "With Reich's description of orgastic potency, we enter the specific Reichian domain. The very silence of this world, a world of slow, frictional movement, of lapse of consciousness, of involuntary contractions, sets it apart from the usual analytic concern with verbalization and cognitive mastery of the emotive and irrational. Indeed, there is irony in the fact that Reich chooses, as his criterion of mental health, the individual's capacity to go beyond mental phenomenon, to have no thought, no consciousness even, but to surrender completely to the involuntary, to the sensations of pleasure." In this emphasis on the wordless, the ineffable, Reich revealed himself as closer to the truths of certain philosophers and poets than to his fellow psychoanalysts. Nietzsche had written, quote, "All the regulations of mankind are tuned to the end that the intense sensation of life is lost in continual distractions," end quote. Wittgenstein inserted that the most important matters of life were essentially not discussable. They were beyond words, end quote. If some social activists tune out when they hear about orgasms and sex freedom, their ears return to the subject of mass psychology. We know that advertising has managed to drive people into consumerism, using only the mind. Is there a mental doorway where social justice and environmentalism can enter? How do corporations and the state use mass psychology? Wilhelm Reich absolutely pioneered this field. While still an accepted prodigy of Sigmund Freud, he was among the first to transfer the ideas of individual analysis to society as a whole. He called it mass psychology. His seminal 1933 book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, is important to read, especially now, as industrial fascism threatens to take over a naive public. In the late spring of 1927, Reich had just returned from a rest cure in Davos, Switzerland, likely for tuberculosis, which was sweeping Eastern Europe. TB killed his brother. On July 15, 1927, one of his patients informed him that the workers of Vienna were in the streets in protest. Reich went out to join them, as he reported in his later work, People in Trouble. The crowds burned the Vienna courthouse as a protest against injustice, following which the police fired into the crowd, which included Reich and his wife Annie. After 3 hours of shooting, there were over 1,000 wounded and 89 dead. It was the worst outbreak since the 1848 revolution, and Reich was there for the power and the slaughter. Reporting on these events, Reich used a new style of journalism that included his own reactions, a type of journalism that reappeared with the 1960s and 70s mass protests in Europe and the United States. His experience of social violence brought about a change in Reich's writing and research, moving away from the analysis of individuals to the causes of social conservatism and control. Reich became involved with the leftist Austrian Social Democrats and the Communists, trying to bring his solution of sexual liberation to both movements. Both eventually refused a platform of sexual politics. This was part of a wider movement stressing sexuality as a fundamental social problem. The World League for Sexual Reform, for example, was meeting in 1930. Wilhelm Reich was a keynote speaker. Tired of trying to cure people's mental unhappiness and neurosis in what he considered a sick society, Reich said society could improve mental health by social measures, just as it had improved physical health with sanitation. Society, Reich said, should ensure housing and food for its poorest members. Women needed safe access to abortion, and both men and women needed contraceptives and sex education to prevent unwanted pregnancies. To help people find less damaging lives, Reich proposed major changes to the laws governing marriage and divorce, the very kind of laws now in place and taken for granted. Reich thought all this could only come about under socialism. Still, he thought individual neurosis would continue to crop up, partly due to social maladaptation to the natural realities of sexuality. Following Freud, he thought character and character problems developed early, from toddlerhood to children aged up to 6. He asked disquieting questions about children's sexual impulses. These exist everywhere, but are denied by everyone. Masturbation, for one example, was still punished in most households. Did the Depression of the 1930s castrate the movement for sexual reform? Was the Depression itself, the lack of confidence that allowed the stock to crash and industry to close, a form of sexual anxiety, a kind of social impotency? Economic man lost confidence in his power. In his later book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, Reich explained his major theories. The repressed and denied sexual urges made people afraid and pliable to power. The social machinery to frustrate sex energy hardened in the muscles of the body, so that a person became stiff in character, in their emotions, and in their way of moving. Life energy was used up in forcing the unenforceable, leaving people tired and politically apathetic. Lies about love enabled lies about power and wealth. But people who could tap into their sexual energy would wake up and care about their society as well. Sharaf explains, quote, "As the women's movement in the United States was to emphasize many years later, it was necessary to begin with the personal, to politicize the personal. The political right, especially Nazism, as we shall see, was well aware of this. Its leaders constantly used sex propaganda, but of a negative kind. They played on people's fear of their own impulses and their fear of chaos. By calling upon the need for moralistic defenses, for law and order, for protection against the Bolshevik menace to the family." In this sense, Reich wrote, the Catholic Church was the most powerful sex political organization in the world. End quote. Do you think that this is all over? Remember, an American president was harassed because of his sex life, not his performance as president. Otherwise competent executives tumble over their affairs. And the religious right is pushing morality while drawing guilty voters to the polls. In America, sexuality is attacked as a law and order issue in almost every major political campaign, and items such as homosexual marriage continue to dominate the headlines. The same fear of revolt against parental sexual taboos may also explain the slow development of environmental awareness. Sexual repression and fear may use up the consciousness required to evaluate the real situation on the planet. No wonder people gravitate toward the latest sex trial of a pop star, but find disintegrating climate too boring to bother with. Reich thought that the sexual repression was used by adults to create authority, to make an individual ready for domination. This process was carried on by the schools until we fear our inner selves, but trust the worst political rats. We can't revolt or question authority because of our awful inner fears, which may begin with early sexuality, says Reich. This same pattern of domination has been used down through the ages. In The Mass Psychology of Fascism, Reich said, quote, "Suppression of the natural sexuality in the child, particularly of its genital sexuality, makes the child apprehensive, shy, obedient, afraid of authority, good and adjusted in the authoritarian sense. It paralyzes the rebellious forces because any rebellion is laden with anxiety. It produces, by inhibiting sexual curiosity and sexual thinking in the child, a general inhibition of thinking and critical faculties. In brief, the goal of sexual suppression is that of producing an individual who is adjusted to the authoritarian order and who will submit to it in spite of all misery and degradation." End quote. Sharaf concludes, "Today, from the efforts of such social analysts as Eric Fromm, Theodore Adorno, and Richard Hofstadter, we have become very familiar with the notion that to understand political movements, one must grasp the psychological structure of the people connected with them. but when Reich wrote The Mass Psychology of Fascism in 1933, almost 10 years before Fromm's Escape from Freedom, almost 20 years before The Authoritarian Personality, his ideas were exceedingly original. End quote. There are some truths about ourselves we refuse to know as a society. The mechanism of repressing truth may begin with our own denial of childhood sexuality. Once repression is learned, it can spread to exclude other truths, including our mass desire for death, our suicidal weapons of mass destruction, our killing of nature. We must adapt to the truth of our lifestyles and the global situation, because human lies always collapse sooner or later. We cannot continue to suppress obvious biological truths in nature. Later, Reich was to see such social neurosis as a form of emotional plague. The emotional plague opens us up to all sorts of madness. Needless bombing of cities, huge thefts from corporations and the public treasury. And we stand by, fascinated, shouting and applauding for the murder of Christ the Truth Teller, or Ali, the rightful heir.
The Strange Case of Wilhelm Reich.
As we review the life and ideas of Wilhelm Reich, we reach into his research of the life-giving force, the something that makes us alive and all things live. In Norway and in America after 1939, Reich was trying to discover the physics of life itself. He called it orgone, which contains both the idea of organism, but also orgasm, which Reich regarded as a necessary penultimate consciousness. Having claimed to discover this life energy, Reich corresponded with governmental and scientific authorities, including Einstein, about his scientific theories. Meanwhile, he was pilloried in a series of reprints of a journalistic piece in the New Republic called The Strange Case of Wilhelm Reich. Written by Mildred Edie Brady, it was a sort of Reader's Digest piece. As part of a conspiracy of discreditation, Brady's piece was republished, as though it was authentic science, in the Bulletin of the Menninger Clinic, number 12. More on the Cold War politics of the media attack on Reich follows in our continuing story. The pathetic thing about Reich, aside from being martyred in every country for his pioneering views on sexuality and the individual, was that he was jailed, where he died, for attempting to introduce the study of life energy. He sought to penetrate the force that appears to drive the wondrous varieties of life on this planet, instead of settling for a mechanical description of life. Even if Reich's science was faulty, even if a lifetime of trying to help an insane society had disturbed his own sanity, the atomic society around him, the people of mad, mutually assured destruction, very badly needed a new idea, even if it was a myth of life, not death. At least Reich wrote out his other book, The Mass Murder of Christ, before he had to live it out. His tale is a cautionary one for the great searcher of truth. How risky it is to stray too far from the social mind when trying to understand the mass psychosis of the times. Did Nietzsche also pay this price? What about the French writer Antoine Artaud? In 1954, the Food and Drug Administration got a legal judgment against Reich. They claimed his orgone accumulators were a type of medical fraud. A judge ordered all accumulators destroyed and all literature associated with them to be destroyed also. The FDA interpreted this to mean all of Reich's writings should either be destroyed or edited out, presumably by hand, to remove any mention of the idea of orgone energy. In modern America, writing about the life force was to be burned or censored, medieval style. All this violation of civil liberties and basic human rights was praised by the psychiatric and psychoanalytic associations of the day. Reich responded by threatening to change the weather to flood parts of Maine. He had been experimenting with electronic devices to alter conduction in the atmosphere, perhaps a precursor to the infamous HAARP program run by the U.S. government in Alaska, which also threatens climate change, among other things. There were a few protests about Reich's case in those McCarthyite days of atomic repression and widespread censorship of dissenting public opinion. On June 26, 1956, FDA agents burned Wilhelm Reich's research library, his journals, his books, his letters. On August 23, 1956, federal agents forced the burning of another 6 tons of Reich's literature. The pile included, oh, irony of ironies, hard-covered copies of The Mass Psychology of Fascism. Few protested this treatment of the famous author and physician. There was a study about the weird FDA vendetta against Reich, written by Jerome Greenfield. Ralph Nader paid for another investigation into the Reich case in 1970. People repressed Reich, along with their own fears of talk about sexuality. Authority won. Any social activist needs to consider these risks, a violent public and authoritarian reaction, even to life-generating instincts. Perhaps, for example, this also explains resistance to the paradigm of renewable non-polluting energy, and the lack of public concern with organized harassment of environmentalists, including harassment by government agencies, again. Reich's vision of life energy was made illegal by the U.S. government. Wilhelm Reich was forbidden to research or write about it. Was Reich attempting to found a new paradigm, a life-saving myth, marked by his own martyrdom? And what if we accept Reich's vision of life energy? He was not the first to seek such a thing. Physics had already discovered a new energy in radiation when, in 1903, an eminent French physics professor announced N-rays, a dim form of light which he thought emanated from living things, and perhaps from the mind. N-rays may have represented psychic energy. They were later found not to exist. What if we accepted Reich's myth that there is a life energy, that it can be accumulated, that it is hurt by pollution and radiation, that it resides inside the armored core of each of us? This life energy is everywhere. It appears on craggy, frozen cliffs and in the deepest sea bottom. Life pops up in the scientist's sealed laboratory dish arriving from the air. Life is as likely to colonize machines as vice versa. It cracks open the heaviest stone monuments and eats away the strongest steel. Life adapts to ice or lava. Does anyone who proposes or worships such life energy trigger the mechanisms of defensive authority or the death instinct of the masses? Who can speak for life energy, for orgone, if you will, without being denied and reviled? Is this why environmentalism is such a difficult calling?
EcoShock Radio, broadcast and podcast. Find us on the web at ecoshock.org.
The Strange Case of Wilhelm Reich.
Wilhelm Reich as an early environmentalist. Previously, we followed the turbulent life of Wilhelm Reich, the medical doctor and psychoanalyst, who thought sexual liberation would reduce our dependence on authoritarian governments and institutions. In the aftermath of Hiroshima and during the atmospheric atomic testing in America in the early 1950s, Wilhelm Reich was one of the first to worry publicly about the effects of radiation and the deterioration of the atmosphere generally from pollution. At the time, he was somewhat desperately attempting to find scientific proof of a life force, which he called orgone energy. He hoped an understanding of life energy could counteract the obvious death wish of the Cold War society. All the while, Reich had to fight a kind of double conspiracy by the Food and Drug Administration, apparently acting on behalf of the mind doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists, and by the FBI, under the sexually perverted J. Edgar Hoover, repressing his own homosexuality and cross-dressing while persecuting others for the same. Hoover pursued Reich as a former communist supporter in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. It didn't help that Reich was one of the first medical professionals to warn about the dangers of atomic testing. Let's listen to Myron Sharaf in his book, Fury on Earth, a biography of Wilhelm Reich, published in 1983. Reich had investigated the impact of radiation on living things, on the life energy he called orgone. It was called the Orener experiment. Quote, "Finally, in retrospect, one is struck by how prescient Reich was. Today, atomic tests, nuclear wastes, and harmful X-rays can produce public outrage. But such was not the case in 1951. Within weeks of the Orener experiment, Reich was concerned about the effects of all kinds of toxic influences, chemical offal, electromagnetic pollution, on atmospheric and organismic orgone energy. I recall thinking, back in 1951, that his concern with minute traces of radium on watch dials and TV emissions was excessive, if not insane. Today, the use of radium in watches is rapidly declining. Effects of fluorescent lights have been noted, and people are advised not to sit too close to TV sets." He became concerned not only with the dangers of nuclear radiation, but also with chemical pollution and the danger from non-nuclear forms of electromagnetic emissions. The latter, too, he noted, could, in sufficient dosage, irritate orgone energy in a noxious way. Since the 1960s, the classical theory of radiation sickness has grown more similar to Reich's in its recognition that relatively low levels of nuclear radiation and non-nuclear emissions, for example from microwaves, can have harmful cumulative results. End quote. As an aside, it is known that life forms move through the lower atmosphere. If we lay out food, for example, something arrives via the air to grow there, perhaps a fungus. Reich also raised the issue of the effect of pollution and atomic radiation on such airborne and invisible parts of our ecosystem, rather than just directly on ourselves as human organisms. This subject is still understudied, even today. Human-made atmospheric pollution, where life creates conditions hostile to itself, Reich called DOR, a short form for deadly orgone energy. In a somewhat paranoid style, he began to sense that some days the atmosphere contained more of this DOR energy than others. Perhaps it was a day when the U.S. was testing plutonium on Eastern America, or the beginnings of the acid rain clouds that destroyed New England forests and ate away at her rocks and monuments. Later, by 1953, he wondered if the DOR energy was left by aliens, perhaps even a kind of exhaust from their vehicles? Again, here is Sharaf, the patient and thoughtful biographer of Reich. Quote, "Reich describes the emotional flavor, his words, of DOR clouds in a manner reminiscent of the 19th century art critic John Ruskin. Indeed, the comparison goes further since Ruskin was, to my knowledge, the first writer to comment on the atmospheric effects of intensive coal usage in England in the 1880s. End quote. Reich attempted to devise a mechanism to divert such harmful clouds, or to cause rain. He invented a system of tubes and electricity, which was tried out, with some reports of success, in both New England and the American Southwest. Reich experimented with cloud control. Frustrated with the deadly atomic game between the West and Russia, in his letters from prison in 1956, Reich pleaded for harbors for life, churches for life, and sanctuaries for life. We still need harbors for life, and sanctuaries too, as we try to save small spaces of the remaining natural biosphere and small places for our own individuality within our technical shells. We know what he meant. Further research regarding Reich's suspicious death in jail is contained in the article titled "Who Killed Wilhelm Reich?" by Jim Martin. It is part of a fascinating collection of underground and cult classics in the book Apocalypse Culture, published in 1990 and updated in 1994. The book bills itself as part of the literature of catastrophism. Jim Martin picks up on the Wilhelm Reich conspiracy, saying, quote, "In my view, Wilhelm Reich was in prison because he stumbled into frightening facts about nuclear radiation during the early 1950s, a critical point in that newly developed industry. Simply put, Reich found that there is no shielding possible against the biological effects of nuclear radiation. on January 5, 1951, in what was called the Orener experiment, Reich placed a minute sample, 1 milligram, of iridium inside the powerful orgone accumulator. Reich's shocking report, which can be found in the now out-of-print selected writings, details how radiation sickness is a function of the organism's response to the invasive insult, and not a direct result of the radiation poisoning itself. Thus, different people may be more susceptible to the very minute doses, while others may feel no noticeable effects. Each person's reaction is different according to their own emotional and biological structure. End quote. And this may explain why some people react to radiation, even in minute doses, more than others do. As the original book may be hard to find, we reproduce his important argument here. Quote, "It will be recalled that there was little understanding of the biological effects of radiation in the 1950s. Many people remember that soldiers were sent directly into test sites shortly after the dust cleared from nuclear explosions. They wore no protection and were merely dusted off afterwards." At this writing, January 1994, the U.S. Department of Energy has released many documents about the true nature of America's nuclear heritage. Department Secretary Hazel O'Leary has offered full disclosure about the years of chronic abuse of an unwitting population of human guinea pigs by the scientific establishment and the military. So far, reports have focused to the more insane injection of human beings with plutonium without informed consent. Less has been reported about the facts that first came out, that throughout the 1940s and 1950s, the military dropped radioactive dust over vast areas of the western states. To put this into perspective, the military essentially turned each of us into a huge cohort of experimental subjects in an ongoing test of the biological effects of radiation poisoning. There is little public understanding today of the true nature of Reich's research. However, the military, as of 1948, was fully comprised of his findings. Indeed, the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, provided Reich with the radium samples he used in the Orener experiment. End quote. So, there were massive environmental crimes against the home population to be hidden. Reich further came to the attention of authorities when he corresponded with, and then met with, the grand old man of American nuclear weapons, Albert Einstein. Reich had discovered and attempted to communicate the fact that even low levels of radiation can harm living things. At the time, the government was secretly using the American population to test for radiation effects. They had every reason to shut him up. The Soviet government, under Joseph Stalin, was likewise involved in an all-out atomic development without any regard for the health of its own citizens or the long-term environment. By researching radiation sickness, Reich had stumbled into this nuclear interrelationship, both hostile and friendly. He was crushed by what he perceived as an orchestrated attack by the press, official organizations, and bureaucracy. The emerging record, such as it is, appears to support Reich's general thesis of a conspiracy against him to silence him. Jim Martin reports, quote, "Venom was stirred up by Michael Strait's The New Republic under the editorship of the pro-Stalinist presidential candidate, Henry Wallace. A reporter interviewed Reich under false pretenses and finally wrote about Reich's sex cult. This brought the crisis to a head. The FDA launched a multi-million dollar investigation of the orgone accumulator, declared it a fraud, and set about bringing criminal proceedings against Reich. Reich's FBI files reveal a blistering blizzard of letters directed towards getting rid of Reich, from doctors in the AMA, ministers of Christian Youth Crusades, and one from the Atomic Energy Commission, advising the FDA what a, quote, thorn in the side, end quote, Reich had been, end quote. All this storm of death-making and evil descended on the New England house of one Wilhelm Reich. They hauled him away, burned his books and letters, and left him to die with thieves and murderers in Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary. That concludes our series on Wilhelm Reich.
You've been listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Join us next Friday and every Friday for Radio EcoShock.